and find the studio. And the studio is mainly still in one piece. I do understand that it was invaded by some very odd people. I found this strange picture in here. Obviously, whoever made strange. So evidently, someone with no personal knowledge of cycling was in here. I heard that there was some discussion of this as an indication of witchcraft, which again shows some level of confusion on the part of people. This is called a straw man, and there's this straw man argumentation thing. Anyway, I think I moved the little lighter. It's probably good. I moved the lighter. Didn't have a lighter in here because some of the people who were in here, I'm not sure that would have been safe for them. So, anyway, I didn't really look very closely behind me to see if there are any strange books being hidden in the camera shot, because I heard some people were thinking about doing something like that. But it looks, I don't see left behind anything like that. So I think I'm safe. There's a bunch of stuff by William Lane Craig down here on Molinism. That's always weird. But other than that, we're good. We're good. The Enterprise D is still here. The Tribbles, the Borg Cube. We're good. We're good. We're back. Let me just thank everybody who made Give Rich a Raise. Wow. Did you see the there's a hashtag in the channel, Give Rich a Raise. Actually, it looks like a very long French word, but anyway, let me just thank everybody who made the last 3 weeks possible. That was a really long trip. 22 days, 5 countries. You might go, I only count 4 countries. I drove from Brno, Czech Republic, which is now Czechia, something like that. They actually officially changed the name just a matter of weeks ago. So no longer the Czech Republic. To Vienna, Austria, to fly from Vienna to Kiev. And so that added Austria to my list. I'm not sure if just visiting an airport really counts, but for my mom, driving through any part of a state meant you had been to the state. So evidently, an airport definitely. If you eat there, you know, stuff like that, then you definitely, yeah, you've been there. So we added Vienna, Austria to the list. So five nations. Yes, I was in London back in March, running across the bridge at Westminster exactly 1 week to the day from that attack. And I was in London for the attack a couple days ago. What? It had nothing to do with me.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wasn't anywhere near it, of course. Most people living over here don't know where Heathrow is in relationship to downtown. If I had stayed downtown where I've stayed the past few times, I would have been very close to it, within a kilometer of the attack. No two ways about it. But anyway, long trip. It was so long that by the time I got done teaching in Kiev, the debate with Peter D. Williams seemed like a lifetime ago. It really did. My understanding is that the video of that will be done very, very soon. You know, somebody's been sitting back here, you know, while I'm living in airports and teaching from 8:30 in the morning to 5:15 in the evening with translation on Roman Catholicism. And, you know, I come back and it's like, so, what you doing? It's like, I'm busy. It's like, okay, all right, whatever. So we've got a video that will be out eventually. The audio has already been posted. And we've already gotten some nice comments. I've appreciated the comments on Twitter that it's nice to hear a Roman Catholic Protestant debate where the people are actually talking to each other rather than just past each other. Despite the fact that we were also, you know, forced to identify each of us, the other, as a formal heretic, you know, there's no compromise. And that's what drives a lot of people crazy, is if you're going to be addressing a subject like that and it's you are very much in opposition to one another, then the mindset is that you should treat one another uncivilly and in a nasty way. And don't ever give anybody the idea that you'd actually like to see them saved. Don't give them any reason to think you'd like to see them actually find something attractive in your commitment to Christ. Well, that's just, you're a compromiser if you do that. Dealt with the Roman Catholics, or the certainly can't do it with a Muslim. we've certainly learned that you can't. No. Do not do anything that could possibly be interpreted as adorning the gospel of Christ or attracting people with grace or mercy. No, that's compromise. You're at one, I'll be careful with my language, some person on Twitter starting the morning of the attack while I was there, while I'm sure they were very safely ensconced and wherever they are, talking about how I was in London having coffee with the terrorists and spinning their actions and all the rest of that stuff. And it's just like, what a bunch of loons. So we had the debate in London, flew to Wittenberg, was there for quite some time. Great time with all the folks there. Spoke at a couple of sessions, gave a presentation on the atonement and the mass. That was well attended, had good response to that. Spoke on Solus Christus in the primary session, with side-by-side translation into German. And my translator, Martin Manson, what a great guy. Love Martin, Christian, all the guys there in Berlin with EBTC. Nick was there, Greg was there. Got to meet some new people. Got to, you know, just great time. And you know, it's pretty fun running around Wittenberg. And I literally ran around Wittenberg. I posted a couple of my runs. I eventually plotted out a nice route around the downtown Wittenberg area that was a whole lot easier to run on. If you're running the street that goes right to the Castle Church, it's pavement stones. It's a good way to kill yourself. Very uneven, difficult to walk on, let alone run on, let alone be safe running on it. So I found a way around that eventually. Discovered that pretty much everybody attending the Shepherd's Conference in Wittenberg, not really big into fitness, because I was the only one out there running at sunrise. So either that or they were just all out really late at night, which I really don't see how that's possible, because almost everything was shut down by 6. Maybe 7. And, you know, Wittenberg's not a large place. It's not a big metropolitan, you know, type place. Anyway, had a great time there. Then went to the Czech Republic, as I said. I cannot pronounce the name of the city. Krnjeritz, or something like that. That language is absolutely amazing. With all the little things you put over letters that completely change the pronunciation of everything, and Krnjeritz or something like that. I don't know how anybody does it. You have to be able to really mess things up. But did a week's worth on Roman Catholicism being translated by Baddock, who was one of my students. I first met him in the textual criticism class I taught in Berlin a number of years ago now. And he was one of the troublemakers in the back of the room. And so side-by-side translation, again, until you've done it, you just, what? Oh, you were moving the microphone around. That normally means you're, yeah. Until you have translated side by side, where you have to stop, start, just no way of realizing how debilitating that is for most people. The cadence you develop, always trying to think, okay, have I gone too far?
where can I break here? It's wow. So we did the best we can in that type of a situation, and there were some other people that could read, that could understand English, that were sort of helping along with some of the more technical terminology when we needed it. But that was really important to do. There's very little good Christian teaching, and as is so often the case, when I was down in South Africa, now in the Czech Republic, everywhere I go, the Baptist Union is in trouble. Everywhere I go. It doesn't matter what nation I go to, the Baptist Union, and you don't hear much that about Baptist unions in the United States, but they are extremely prevalent in the rest of the world. And Baptists cannot get along with, well, let's face it, let's just think of any denomination. Do you know any denomination that gets along real well? It's a fallen world, folks. It's the way it is. Tradition gets in the way of everything. But like down in South Africa, the Baptist Union, conservatives trying to have inerrancy added to the statement of faith, and of course, liberals fighting it. In Czech Republic, it's all about ecumenism. It's all about getting along, which is amazing given, you know, what happened with Hus and everything, the history. And, you know, Hus had a huge impact, and the Reformation did well there initially. And then the Counter-Reformation was just blew everything right out of that nation. I mean, the Catholics took over. And so it's a heavily Roman Catholic area, but a heavily nominally Roman Catholic area as well. But still, you know, the Baptist Union is just playing footsie with Rome. And if you dare point out what the differences are and do it lovingly and accurately, and I had to start, you know, my opening presentation had to be on, should we even be doing this? What's really at stake? And so, you know, I just realized something. That I pulled that forward to try to get that HDMI thing to, and it totally changed the, it wasn't supposed to be in the shot like that. So
on another note, clearly you're going to have a discussion with Jeff. He needs a serious Star Trek education. He didn't even know what those were.
What, the tribbles?
Yeah.
How can anyone not know?
I don't know. He started looking around and he's just like, what's this, you know? And I was shocked.
Well,
so I don't understand how a reformed man,
you know, he spent his youth getting kicked in the head. So,
well, there is that.
So, you know, yeah. he has an excuse for almost anything if he really wants it. So that's a shame, you know. But yeah, I have noticed a certain lack of science fiction strength. Yeah. But we all have our shortcomings. I have many of them myself. So, and yours is interrupting me in the middle of something with something that's completely irrelevant. So anyway, what was I talking about? Oh yeah. So then we did a New Testament reliability, you know, New Testament reliability presentation we've done all around the world. On Saturday, preached on Sunday, traveled Sunday through Vienna to Kiev, and then the last week, and thankfully, was only pretty much in the mornings, because by then, starting that Monday, I was now at a record length, longest time I'd ever been overseas, away from home. I'm homebody. I'm not really. Jeff's beard is a tribble. Oh. There is, yeah, yeah. I'm not sure which trouble, but
see
yeah.
now we can figure out why the confusion.
Okay. Anyway, I was teaching on apologetics, and thankfully in Kiev I have my dear brother Nick, and Nick can translate the way they do it at the UN. Even though at the UN they only have the poor person translating live concurrently for like half an hour, he can do it for hours on end. He is the translation machine. And of course he could I really think Nick could teach all the classes I go over there and teach anyways, to be perfectly honest with you. He's a scholar in his own right. And so we did that. That did give me at least opportunity to try to catch up on a little rest in the afternoons. And then the last one, real quickly, I did get a cool opportunity to meet Pastor Van Lees and his son in Ukraine. Van, the church there in St. Charles, Missouri, is the church I've been going to for 15 years, first weekend in December for 15 years now. Only missed once, and I was in Ukraine for that one. And Van's been going over there for a lot longer than I have. And just happened that he and his son were there at the same time I was. They used to go out to Donetsk, but that's now a war zone. It's under the control of the rebels, a.k.a. the Russians. You know, they're just, Russians just lopping off parts of Ukraine as they want more land. Who was it that always wanted more land in Europe? Van and his son are incredibly accomplished musicians, and they were there with David Friesen, which, if you know jazz music, David Friesen's just one of the biggest names in modern jazz music. And so they teamed up for a concert in Kiev, and Greg White was kind enough to drive me into Kiev to attend it. And it was really neat to get to see him someplace other than St. Charles, where I see him each year. And the music was great. I posted a little brief clip from my iPhone of them playing. And Van does the alto sax, and his son is a concert pianist, classical, but he also does jazz. He's just incredibly talented. And David Friesen's on this really cool looking bass. And that was a really cool thing to be able to do. And I also mentioned this morning on Facebook that Nick and I did a real quick run through of the World War II Museum there in Kiev, and that was amazing. I had seen a monument while we were driving through Kiev, sunken down in this big park, and I think it was Greg that pointed to it, and they said, "Yeah, that's World War II monument. The Germans drove 150,000 people." Into that park, and then just mowed them down with machine guns. 150,000 people. And that's what the monument is to the massacre of 150,000, one shot. Well, it wasn't one shot, obviously. Ukraine really bore the brunt of the Nazi invasion and the war crimes that resulted from it. And there's still... Ukrainians aren't big on Germans. Nah, that's not... Yeah. And it goes back to the war. Which, while 75 years ago, still, passes down over time. So yes, I was in London then. I flew back. You can't really get from Kiev back here straight shot the way we want to do it. And so I had to overnight at Heathrow. So I was out at Heathrow when the attack took place. I was asleep. I woke up in the morning and someone said, "I hope you're safe." And I'm like, "Huh?" And in fact, the first person to contact me on Facebook to ask if I was okay was a Muslim. I mentioned that in the comments that I made on Facebook before I had to catch my flight yesterday or day before yesterday, whenever it was, and fly back here to the United States, where I will be for about a month, and then we're headed up to the Denver area for a couple of weeks. I'm going to be speaking at a number of local churches in the Denver area. And then in August, London again, and Johannesburg, so back to South Africa, continuing in the doctoral work there, teaching there, and Durban, trying to set up debates. So the travel fund this year is going to be used a lot, and we need your assistance. I consider it a tremendous privilege to be able to go around the world and teach. Amazing the places where this program is listened to regularly. I don't know how. We've never sought to advertise, promote. We don't have funny sound effects and cool graphics. We frequently talk about strange and in-depth things, here we are. And so that's what we did there. As I said, we will be getting the video up, and it'll be interesting to see how people differ in their watching of the debate and their listening to the debate. You know, remember the Kennedy-Nixon stuff? It'll be interesting to see what comes of that when that gets out. And the other side might have theirs out even before before we get ours out, because they've had my material and stuff for, you know, 4 or 5 days already. Rebel Librarian on Twitter, Dr. Oakley 69, major shout out to Nick on Russian Language Day. That guy is a linguistic superhero. Well, whoever Rebel Librarian is evidently knows Nick. And it is an incredible capacity to be able to listen to someone speaking through headsets and then speak in another language what they're saying. But when we'd want to have interaction, then I'd have Nick come out, and if people wanted to ask questions and things like that. And I remember this, I gave this one answer to somebody. It was sort of the beginning of an answer. And Nick just goes on and on. And so I knew, because he knew knows the guy's better than I do, that he was giving background to my answer that he knew they would need. And that's what's so cool is that when Nick and I work together, I can just kick back and go, yeah, fine. That's not how it would be with most folks. And I caught Raddick a few times, paraphrasing a few things. What was that one thing I caught him on? I don't know. You know, it's always when you think about translation, it's next to impossible to speak without using idioms, because we do it all the time, that just won't translate into another language. And so that translator's constantly having to search for what's the closest idiom in my language. And so in general, when you're doing live high-speed translation, you end up with the New Living Translation version of what the other guy's saying. It's almost always has to be a paraphrase. And sometimes, like in Czech, they would say, I would use this term, or actually he said something like this. And it was sort of a team effort, how it ended up working out. So, but anyway, it was quite the trip. And so I'm home for a month. And already at 90K on the bike so far. I've got a lot of catching up to do. I only picked up about 1.4 kilograms. So, well, no, 1.1 kilograms. That's only like maybe 2 pounds, I think. Is that what it is? Yeah, I think it's like 2 pounds. It's just so hard when you travel. Your schedule's messed up, and you can't control your portion size, and when McDonald's is your default safety place, it's just the way it is. So I've got a lot of work to do. I'm going to try to get at least like 350 kilometers in this week on bike, and just drive myself in the ground. And it's pretty easy to sweat right now here in Phoenix. So this weekend, I was going to say the weather prophecy. That's an odd way of putting it. Yeah, Monday, 98 degrees. So there's still a 90-something in there. Down to 73 for a low that night. Woo! But, of course, by Thursday, it's back up to 107. So next week is the Southern Baptist Convention. And so we may have some visitors, either to observe or to actually participate in the program next week. So I don't know. hey, Southern Baptist guys, does it really help that much? The hotel rooms are that much cheaper in June? Because I don't know. There's some great times to come to Phoenix for conventions. There really are. I'm pretty much any time from November through March. It's going to be wonderful here. It's going to be great. But June? I mean, really? It just must be really much cheaper this this time of the year, because it's just like 100 and my car said 110 yesterday. I saw 110 on the way home. So 108, 110 in the shade. And so yeah, welcome to Phoenix, guys. Nice to have you here. We'll talk a little bit more about them here in a moment. So much stuff. I mean, before I go to this, let's go ahead and at least talk about the amazing stuff that happened while I was gone in regards to the absolute totalitarianism of the left in our day. I refer specifically to the action of the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, which has come out with its own decree. Mary Hassan, in her article on The Federalist, said the science deniers are running the LGBTQ show over at the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, and dissenters will not be tolerated. To quote, announcing it, quote, will not tolerate exposing LGBTQ children and youth to staff and providers who are not supportive of children and youth's right to self-determination of sexual gender and identity. So, fundamentally, ouch, what you have, if I ever just start screaming, it's because something cramped up, because I hurried this morning. I did a hard ride this morning, and then I had to hurry in, so I didn't do all the stretching that I should have. So my body just warned me that we could have a moment that would end up being saved and posted on YouTube forever. Look, James White speaking in tongues. No, it will not be speaking in tongues. It will be the left hamstring tying itself in the proverbial knot. Anyway, the wacko leftists in Illinois, and I do not apologize for referring to these people as wacko leftists. They are totalitarians. They cannot defend their position in any meaningful dialogue. They are the people who shout you down. They are the people who scream you down. This idea, did you see how fast we went from a Obergefell to the utter destruction of human sexuality and gender, male and female roles, everything? It's all fluid now. It's all whatever I feel like. It's whatever. It's amazing. It happened very, 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 very quickly. And this was all part of a plan. It was laid out many decades ago, as you probably know. And the people, especially in positions of authority, who buy into this worldview, simply cannot live with the idea of any dissent. And there's a reason for this. Oh, and by the way, the other thing is Ottawa, up in Canada. Ottawa's what's it called? Bill 89, which is even more draconian than Illinois. What Illinois has said is, if you're a Christian, we don't want you involved with foster care any longer. We only want non-Christians. We only want secularists involved in foster care. That's what they've said. Now, given that there's a tremendous need for foster care, and it's normally Christians who help provide that, this is abject stupidity on the part. But again, totalitarians don't care about what's right, what's best for children, logic, rationality. They're totalitarians. They cannot brook any kind of objection, any kind of expression of any other viewpoint than their own. And so what's going on here when you think about it? I'm trying to find this graphic that I... maybe if I put it in this. Oh, that didn't help any. Oh, wait, no, it might. It might. It did. Yay. I've got a really cool graphic here, and I'll have to fire up the... just fired up a weather program. That's not going to help. I know it's hot outside. Don't bother telling me that. I have a graphic that I'm going to show you here. And if that's going to work for you, just a second. It's unfortunately trying to convert 8 movies, which it's not going to be able to do. Someone, by the way, someone on Twitter said, please do a short debate review too. When I get a chance, I want to address some issues. Once the videos are out, then I will. One of the things I definitely want to do is to deal with some of the patristic references that there wasn't any time to deal with during the course of the debate. But there. Well, yeah. Well, that messes everything up. Yeah. Well, I guess I can use it for now. That's not the one you want. No, that's the best thing I'll be able to do. If I go full screen on it, it puts it on the other screen and you don't get it. So you just got to play with that and zoom in on it or do something. So this is a graphic that, I developed for my debate with Dan Barker a number of years ago, and I've used it a number of times. And it illustrates the problem with secularism and the epistemological ramifications of being a secularist, which we're seeing in the totalitarianism of these radicals who simply will not allow for any other view than their own. If you have a secular worldview, man is in the center. Because man is the one directly interacting with and having knowledge of everything around him. And so man has to interpret science and morality, love, others, law, God, government, history. These are all separate, they're non-integrated facts. There's nothing that holds them together. And the result is, given that man is not omniscient and that man lacks the capacity because he's ignorant, he's finite, he learns over time, but no man can hold all of these things together. And so what you end up with is the necessity of radical skepticism and really the destruction of human knowledge. Because man is insufficient to be able to define these things, let alone to properly identify the relationship of each of these items to one another. They become separate things. And so each individual will emphasize whatever their particular interest is and will prioritize that over other things. And so this is the problem that you have when you have man at the center of all things. Man is insufficient to be able to function in this way. But this is all you've got when it comes to the secular worldview. There's no other way to do it because of the reality that man is the one having to make sense of all this data. And now today there's just too much data for any one human mind to even begin to be able to work with. So you compare that with the Christian worldview. And now at the center of the Christian worldview is the triune God. And man, me, down here, you'll notice the reciprocal arrows going back and forth between me and the triune God. Now it's the triune God who identifies all the things that he, in his omniscience and in his purpose, has made and defined around us. So government, love, law, even I, there's an arrow to me. So my purpose, my position, my identity is defined by the triune God. And so I have relationship to God and through God to anything else, to others, to law, to morality. And no longer do I have to be the ground of all knowledge. Now, God, who possesses within himself the capacity to be the ground of all knowledge, because he's the creator of all things, my knowledge comes through him. It's mediated to me by him. And as such, I do not need to have infallibility. I do not need to understand everything there is to know about science. But because the triune God is in the center, when I have the knowledge that comes from him, it's still true knowledge. See, in the other graphic, any knowledge I have is provisional and frequently false, simply because I do not possess within myself the ground for understanding how everything is related to everything else. And so my knowledge is going to be easily falsifiable. But in the Christian worldview, God has that ground within himself because he's the creator of all these things. And so while my knowledge is limited, the knowledge I get from God is limited, it is true knowledge. In the other graphic, it's both limited and you just simply have to be skeptical. You don't know one way or the other. And so the people in this graphic, in the secular position, once they've put themselves here, then they get to define who God is. They get to define what morality is. And if I have a different morality because I'm up here and the triune God says, this is what is moral because I have defined it in that way. If I said to a person who is here, that is a direct attack upon their centrality. That is a direct attack upon their very source of knowledge. And what we're seeing on college campuses, university campuses, in the halls of government, is once that Christian foundation is washed away, not just washed away, but absolutely purposefully rejected, spit in God's face rejected, this is the result. And it leads to a form of totalitarianism. And we're seeing it. In Ottawa, they're actually saying that we can take your children unless you buy into an absolute moral insanity. It's evil, but it's also insane. It is absolutely insane that I am what I think I am. That is insanity. It is pure insanity. I cannot begin to respect it. It doesn't even enter into the realm of adulthood. Because there are biological reality facts that all my thinking in the world is not going to change. And to say that we will take your children from you. I mean, this is Big Brother on steroids, and it's here. And the question then becomes, what do you do if they come for your children? Flee? Run? Fight? Depends on what your situation is, I guess. But these people want your children because they know they cannot possibly continue this abject destruction of human culture if they are forced to defend their position in any type of meaningful debate. That's why these people are not known for their rational defense of their position. The only positive thing I can see here is no culture that does this will long last. It will be replaced by something else, because you cannot live in God's world and spit in God's face and pretend that the laws he's put in place don't apply to you. They do apply to you, and they will, and he has ways of making sure you know that. He has ways of making sure you know that. So a lot of people, there hasn't been a lot of coverage of this because of the terrorist attacks and things like that. But my goodness, folks, amazing stuff. Truly, truly amazing stuff. Well, let's press on, because even as I'm sitting here, other stuff is crossing my mind. And everybody on Twitter was saying, you'll never get to open phones. Well, we might. We'll see. Depends on how long we go. But I do want to make a few brief comments about what has happened. We had the attack last time I was in London. We had Manchester. You must understand the mindset of the foreign Wahhabi-style jihadist. Someone would look at the Manchester attack and go, but that performing artist, that venue, that style of music, all represents to them the satanic influence of the West. No question about it. And as a result, yeah, it makes sense why. Now, little teenagers, teeny boppers, yeah, you want to terrorize them. You want to terrorize them. That's the whole idea. And, you know, if you can get them to, you know, how many of those people that were at that concert will never be able to go to another concert again? They will never, you know, let's say, especially if they were, you know, injured or very close to being injured. There are people there that'll never go again. And every single person in that group will think twice before they ever go again. That's exactly what they want. It's exactly what they want. Now, as normal, unfortunately, after one of these attacks, has anything changed? Is there any advancement in the level of conversation in regards to what to do or what can be done? I don't see any. There are, on the one hand, amongst the Muslims, you have certain people who simply will not deal with the reality that the people doing these things, some of them, I recognize not all of them. I recognize, look, if you can factually demonstrate that some of the people who even kill themselves, I mean, the ones in London had these fake suicide vests on, so you know why they did that? To be certain that they would die. Because they know what the protocol is. If you're wearing a suicide vest, it's a headshot. That's what the armed forces, the police, security forces, the military, whoever, you don't get close enough to try to apprehend such a person. You kill them. You from as far a distance as you can. with a rifle as best if possible, and you do a headshot. There's no putting somebody in prison, no getting information. When they went out dressed like that to do what they did, they had absolutely no intention of ever coming back. They were guaranteeing that they were not going to come back. Now, why do people do things like that? Well, there are obviously different motivations. And if you have people who go out in the days and weeks before doing something like this and basically visit prostitutes and get drunk and have a good old time, that's obviously a different motivation and a different worldview than the person who thinks that they're going to be going to heaven and getting 70 virgins upon their death. And so there are different kinds of people that do these types of things. And there are some down and outers. And then there are other people I've pointed out over and over again. I use the video of the attack on the Glasgow airport in, 2007, I think. It was 10 years ago now. Wow, yeah. Where the two men, the only two people who died were the people in the car, in the Jeep. And they died a horrible death because they were horribly burned. And they died weeks later of their burns. And that's probably about the worst possible way you could ever die. But they were National Health System doctors. They weren't down and outers. They were intelligent, educated men. And they did what they did because they believed that by doing what they did, they were going to be establishing a relationship with their God based upon their willingness to give their lives in service of that God. Now, I what I'm seeing each and every time something like this happens is less and less and less meaningful discussion of the whole terror plague. And you'll see more. Believe me, it's Ramadan. And I follow enough people online to know that many of them just find it abjectly disgusting that at this time of year, there are people engaging this type of behavior. But that's what they do. Every year, it's the same thing. Every year, it's the same thing. And so some Muslims will point out, but that's not. Look at this source. Look at this source. Look at what it says here. Look at what it says there. And the other side says, yeah, but look what it says here. Look what it says there. Look what it says there. And what's really concerning to me is the shrill voices are taking over. And there's almost no meaningful communication taking place. It's just the same knee-jerk reactions. Bunch of people that I follow, you know, it's just all Islam, man. You just got to realize it's just all Islam. Every Muslim, all of Islam, it's war. Go get them. That's what they're thinking. And of course, that produces the same kind of response on the other side. And believe me, if you dare point out that there are Muslims who condemn these activities, that there are all these imams in London that get together, and someone just posted a thing about how many mosques refuse to do funeral ceremonies for these guys. If you point to the number of people who condemn these things and say, see, this is a violation of this and this and this and this, you're just automatically, you're just going to be jumped on. Mindless bigotry, you know, and even people that should know better, people who do know better, to be very honest with you. And of course, no one ever takes the time. I try to explain to folks, you realize that from the Islamic perspective, they look at their community and they see the Wahhabis, some of the Salafis, certainly all these we would call radicals that are willing to engage in jihad without a caliphate. Well, they would say ISIS is the caliphate, I suppose, but without a meaningful caliphate. I'm sorry, but think about it. When you look at the world's Muslims, can you really say that the caliphate, ISIS, somehow speaks for the entire Islamic population? No. And so they are engaging in these activities, and they are violating classical Islamic understandings of what jihad is supposed to be, and they don't care. And so from the Islamic perspective, they look at them and they say, you know, we peaceful Muslims are sort of like the Roman Catholics in that we have developed these traditions, the full spectrum of Sharia law, which doesn't just stop back then, but continues to develop and define things and jurisprudence and so on and so forth. But these radicals are sort of like you Protestants, and not really you mainline Protestants, but sort of like you Baptists. because they come along and they basically say, not Quran only, but they limit the sources from which they will draw their conclusions to a very, very early period, and then cut everything else off and say we don't need to worry about the Sharia and the fiqh and the jurisprudence that developed after a certain point in time, especially with the Salafi, looking at those first few generations as the pure expression of Islam. And the problem is, let's be honest, that's an extremely subjective position to take. It's subjective in the sense that you still have to choose out of a bewilderingly wide variety of sources what you're going to prioritize over other things. And so I have said now for years, and then only a few years ago did people all of a sudden pretend to be shocked, something that seems to me to be absolutely positively a self-evident reality. Obviously not necessarily accepted by my Muslim friends. And that is that the Islamic sources are not consistent sources. You can, depending on what kind of system of interpretation that you choose to construct, or even choose from history, because there are all sorts of different understandings of how you form Sharia, how you interpret ahadith, how you prioritize ahadith. There are numbers of different schools of interpretation. And so I've been saying for a long time that my biggest problem, and I say this to my Muslim friends over and over, they hear it. Funny how my allegedly Christian friends don't. But I've been saying that one of my biggest problems with Islam is it doesn't seem that Islam contains within its own source materials, which would be the Quran and the Hadith, at least some collection of Hadith, the Sunnah of the Prophet, whatever. Those sources are insufficiently consistent to allow any one side to vanquish another side. That's the problem. And it just, it's offensive, and I just don't understand it. Why there are so many people who actually want to just jump up and down on my head and say I'm a terrible, horrible compromiser, because I would dare to point this out. And I would dare to point out that there are Muslims who select the information from this wide body of what seems to me to be contradictory information and create an understanding of Islam that not only has historical precedent, but does not lead them to strap bombs upon themselves to blow other people up, and in fact leaves them in a position to be offended when other people do it and call themselves Muslims. That does not mean that what I'm saying is those people that blew themselves up aren't Muslims. They are drawing from the same sources. They are drawing from the same sources. So the problem is in the sources. And one of my arguments, you know, it's funny, I, you know, wrote that little book on the Quran, and I made this argument in there. And it's funny how a number of folks who now just think I'm a terrible, horrible person used to think that was a good book. Funny how that works, the how people change over time. But what was one of my main arguments? One of my main arguments is that the Quranic understanding of Christian belief, for example, is in error. The author of the Quran did not understand the Christian faith. I've defended that in debate for years before anybody started getting upset with me about it. And it is that inconsistency, that lack of knowledge, that to me is very important, the demonstration that this is not a divine document that we're looking at. If the Quran were a divine document, the author of the Quran would have been able to mount better arguments than the followers of the Quran mount today. That's going to be I'm going to be reviewing a book. I thought about trying to get to it today, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to get to it. But there's a book by Abu Zakaria that I started listening to before I went on my trip. And then I listened again this morning. I'm going to respond to about the first 35 pages or so of it, because on Christian history and the New Testament. And there are a couple of places where I think he's responding to me. But one of the arguments I'm going to make, just sort of giving him a heads up here, because I'd like to be able to have some interaction with him possibly on the subject as well, is that it strikes me that Abu Zakaria clearly has a much more accurate knowledge of the doctrine of the Trinity than the author of the Quran. Now, you may not see why that's a devastating critique, but it is. And if it's true, it means a lot. And in the same way, when we look at those original sources beyond that, we see fundamental inconsistencies in those sources. And since that's the case, how can Islam reform itself? And how can the Muslims, who truly, I recognize, unlike, sadly, most Christians, I recognize that there are Muslims who, upon waking up Sunday morning and hearing what happened in London, are devastated, they're angry, they're sick of this type of activity taking place. And if you think they don't exist, then you're part of the problem. You're how wars get started. You are how atrocities go both directions. That's the problem. And I'm just seeing more and more and more people who just are not even willing to make the effort any longer to think rationally, fairly, or anything. It's just nuke them all. That's what their thinking is. And that's dangerous. That's how civilization collapses into the flames of into bad stuff. So listening to all this stuff that's going on, what do we do about it? Have you noticed how our society, how do formerly Christian secular societies deal with this kind of activity where you have people who are willing to kill themselves? And for what reason? What's this going to accomplish? I mean, one of the fundamental differences between their understanding and my understanding, and I keep pushing it, and I guess people don't like this either. But a lot of these folks will say, well, yeah, look those Muslims, they want to establish Sharia all over the world. Read Philippians 2 recently. As a Christian, you believe that someday every knee will bow. What does that mean in biblical language? What does bowing the knee mean? When we say bowing the knee to Lordship of Christ, what do we mean? That's called, what's the word? Oh, submission. Oh, we don't, maybe we should stop using that word submission, because that's what Muslim means. So we don't want to talk about submission. No, I do. I'm not giving up words just because somebody else is using them. Submission. Someday every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord of the glory of God the Father. That's a undeniable, uncompromisable Christian belief. How is it going to happen? Is it going to happen passively? Or is God eventually going to act in great power? Well, there's this book in the New Testament called the Book of Revelation. It does seem that, the Lamb takes the book from the hand of he who sits upon the throne, and all of created order worships he who sits upon the throne, the Lamb. And he opens the seals, and there's these judgments. And remember all that part? Yeah, that there will be a day coming when God will bring judgment. And that's going to happen. Right now, the only power that's been given to the church to change hearts and minds is the gospel. The only power. And until those seals are broken and the judgment of God begins to fall upon this earth, that's the realm of grace. That's the time for gospel proclamation. And in that time, the greatest thing that we can do is to pray not only for missionaries, but to be missionaries. To be people who extend ourselves in such a fashion as to testify of the gospel of Jesus Christ to the Muslim people. To pray for them, not to hate them, not to walk in, that's what just so disgusting about that group. That, remember I showed you the video last year sometime, or maybe earlier this year, I don't remember what it was, but walking through Muslim areas with crosses, swearing at people. Oh my goodness. You want to help bring about war and religious war? That's a good way to do it. Talk about closing doors of communication. That's best way in the world. That's amazing. But it's a tremendously frightening thing that each time this happens, I hear less and less meaningful interaction and more pure hatred on both sides, even from Christians. Refusing to recognize the distinctions amongst Muslims, even though they demand that the Muslims make those distinctions amongst us. Shouldn't be that way, but the way it is. And I realize that as it becomes more and more shrill, fewer and fewer people will have any room whatsoever for someone like myself that would say, excuse me, if we stop thinking, if we don't maintain the mind of Christ, if we don't think according to godly principles, what's going to be the result? What's going to be the result? It's going to be bad. It's going to be bad. Real quickly, in that same area, I mentioned on Facebook, stories came out about people defending themselves against these knife-wielding maniacs Sunday night. And some people might say, I sense a contradiction between you're talking about putting our lives in line to graciously seek to be witnesses of the gospel amongst the Muslim people, and the idea of defending yourself, running at these people, and literally supporting the idea that we should be able to defend ourselves. And I mentioned on Facebook, guy runs into a restaurant with a big old hunk of knife in Arizona, unless it's one of the stupid restaurants that has a sign out front that says no concealed carry. Not that that really works very well, but he ain't getting very far. He may get a few people because you're just like, what in the world is going on? But, you know, I only semi-jokingly said, you know, can you imagine the difference between New York and San Francisco and Phoenix and Dallas? He's going to get ventilated pretty quick. There's a lot of us that can defend ourselves. We have the means and can do so legally. And some people are like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And you know, I've criticized some statements by John Piper in the past where he has said that he wouldn't defend his home or his family against someone who breaks in. And I'm like, what's the strong man all about in Luke? Unless the strong man is bound, then you're not going to be able to take his property. Well, what do you think the strong man's doing if he's not bound? He's beating the snot out of somebody who breaks into his house, what he's doing, and he's using whatever means that he has to do so. And it's very clear that that's exactly what you'd expect him to do, and it's not a bad thing to do. You have responsibilities to wife and to children and to family and to others. And so, as I mentioned very briefly in the Facebook article, it's a matter of categories. There is a time for gospel witness. There's a time for laying down your life to present the gospel. But when that time comes, when God gives a man over in the evil of his heart to the contemplation of the murder of others and begins to act on that intention, that person has forfeited even their right to life. The shooting of those men down in the street was the absolutely appropriate thing to be done. That was justice. It was right. It was a good thing. These men were running up to women and stabbing them 10, 12 times. That's an evil act. I don't care what you say your motivation was. That is an evil act. And so they were shot down the street. Instant justice. And that's appropriate. And we should be able to defend ourselves. And if someone came busting in to a restaurant that I'm eating at, screaming Allahu Akbar, and slicing up everybody that's nearby, the right thing for me to do. Now, the right thing for me to do before that happens is do everything I can to present God's truth and call that person away from the falsehoods that have them deceived. But once they have been given over to the expression of that kind of murderous attitude, I'm going to drop them right then and there. And no one's going to be able to tell me that doing that is wrong. Because there is a command. You shall not murder, but that implies you shall save life. And if I have the ability to save life, that's what I need to do. And so a lot of people just really struggle at that point, and there are some who are going to disagree. Fine. You show me where I do not have a duty to do what is right, to protect life against evildoers in that situation. And if someone says, well, just leave it to the police. As I said, we have the state-sponsored prayer line, 911. In other places, it's 999. When I travel around the world, it's different numbers. But and everybody's like, they got him within they got him within 8 minutes. Yeah, well, how many people died within 8 minutes? How many people's lives are going to be completely scarred for those 8 minutes if there had just been somebody who could take these guys out? Knives are rough things. No two ways about it. But you don't, there's a reason why you say you don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
Well, and the other saying is, you know, when seconds count, and they count in that scenario, the police are only minutes away.
That's right. Yeah.
So
seconds
how,
count, the police
how
are only
many
minutes away.
Seconds does it take for a man less than 21 feet away from you with a knife to kill you? It only takes less than 10.
Yep.
8 minutes. 8 minutes.
Yeah. Someone in channel rather rightly said you'd be more likely to be condemned for preaching the gospel to a terrorist than shooting them these days. Unfortunately, quite true stuff. Quite true stuff. So, yeah, that'd probably be a good idea. I ignore the disembodied hand here. Oh, well, thank you. All right, so what do we do here? Do I do this next topic, or do we just, well, you know what I forgot to do. I forgot to even find out if I could open the phones, because I keep forgetting that for some reason the phones have disappeared off of this thing here. Oh, look at that. Ho! Yeah, let's go ahead. Let's, now, I don't know why.
Why would someone...
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we're going to have to put that on the other side then or something. Luke talks so loudly, I don't know that he really needed a microphone. I think he could have just sat over there and you would have been turning him down as it was. Room temperature water. That's I know it was cold when you got it so long ago. Anyway, it wets the whistle. 877-753-3341. 877-753-3341. As I look at the other topics that I had queued up, they're just going to take way too long to get into. But one of the things I want to discuss was an article from a Muslim perspective referring to James E. Snap Jr.'s comments about the Case for Christ movie. So it's a Muslim reviewing a majority text Byzantine textual critical scholar criticizing the Case for Christ. What's funny is someone who will remain nameless has criticized me a great deal recently because, well, the Muslims, he's just a useful idiot for the Muslims because they're always quoting stuff like that. Except this very same person has been quoting a bunch of James E. Snap articles. And they're using James E. Snap, so I guess that makes James E. Snap a useful idiot for the Muslims, right? I mean, consistently. But consistency is not this guy's thing anymore by any stretch of the imagination. But I wanted to get into that, and the problem is that'd just be so big. And there's also an article, I think, that appeared just before I left about the 1689 and the ecclesiastical text stuff and the Kami Johannium and all the rest of that, all the rest of that stuff. But there's just so much background material to get into in that it would probably be best to wait. I am hoping, like I said, to have some guests next week. So I'm not, if we don't get to it Thursday, I'm not sure when I will get to it. But we'll see. That's a nice, you got any specifics on that? I mean, come on. That is wide enough to drive a semi tractor trailer through. We need a little bit more specifics there. 877-753-3341. 877-753-3341. 3341 is the phone number. The SBC meeting is next week. Yes. I don't know what that means, but and then we've got, I don't even know if I should look at this. Talk to your cat about, right. Okay. Thanks, regular reformed guys. That was not useful at all. Didn't want to get specific? Okay. All right. Well, that just leaves another phone line open at 877. See, people didn't believe me. They were like, you'll never get, you'll just talk and talk and talk. And so then it's like, well, let's open the phone lines. And people are like, I don't know. 877-753-3341. It takes a few moments to, what? Just hung up? The phones are working, right? Okay, now they're ringing. He's trying to get them, and then it rings, and then it hangs up, and I don't know what that's all about. Meanwhile, I'll just, I wonder if the battery's dead. Yep. I know there's a way to get into this, but I just haven't wanted to do tribble surgery. I didn't know that tribbles had Velcro. This just feels all wrong, digging into a tribble like this. But if you could have done this on Star Trek, they could have really stopped all that procreation going on. Wow, I don't really see how this is going to help me get to the battery anytime soon. Because I do realize this is not the real thing. I thought you'd realize that. If you've not seen the Tribble episode, my highest recommendation is to watch the original episode and then immediately watch the Voyager episode where they go back in time and amazingly have the modern actors interact with the original episode. That was so well done. That was just way, 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 way too good. Okay. It just always concerns me when stuff gets thrown out about contradictions when you don't even have time to look at it. It seems inappropriate. There we go. Why is my mouse not wanting to work here? Okay, there we go. Try bring up at least one of them, so... All right, got one of them. Oh. Okay. All right, well, let's just dive in here. We're not going to get any of these done. So let's talk to Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Dr. White.
Hi. Yes, sir.
Hey, I just wanted to start off and saying that you've been very influential in my life. I used to be a King James onlyist and stuff, and you convinced me otherwise. You've done a very good job.
Okay. Oh, good.
So here's my question. I know that, you know, like you were just talking about, that there are contradictions in the Quran and Hadith. And so I know that Muslims will use verses like Leviticus 26:1, which says, "Ye shall make ye no idols nor graven images, neither rear you up a standing image, neither shall you set up any image of stone." And they'll do that. And then they'll point over to John 3, and where it talks about the serpent being lifted up, and saying, "Hey, look, that's a contradiction. He said no graven image."
Well, it wasn't a graven image. Why go to John 3? It's the same author. It's the same Pentateuch that narrates the plague. And it was the same the same individual and the same God who gave the same command. So going to John 3 is just, I don't even know why anybody would do it. But obviously, Leviticus 26:1 is talking about setting up images of gods to worship them. The serpent was not being worshipped. The serpent represented the means of judgment by which the people were being punished, and the people were to be showing faith by looking to the serpent. That was a demonstration on their part that they realized it was God that was bringing the judgment upon them, that the serpents were his judgment upon them, and that was a just and righteous judgment. So there's no contradiction between the two, because the one is setting up idols to worship, and the other is setting up something that God himself said demonstrates his act of judgment upon the people. So there's no contradiction between the two, and you don't even have to go to John chapter 3 for that, which is funny. I'm not sure why a Muslim would bring that up, because they believe Jesus was a prophet of God, and they quote from the Gospel of John in John chapter 14 and John chapter 16 in regards to alleged prophecies of Muhammad. So if you believe Jesus was a prophet of God, it's pretty hard then turn around and say that he was contradicting himself or contradicting God in the revelation had been given. But we're looking for consistency there. It's probably not a good thing. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much for your call today. And Elizabeth, yes? All right, Elizabeth, hello.
Hello. Greetings from very down south in Arizona. I'm in Marin City and top of a mountain down here. But I wanted to thank you very much for your ministry. I was raised in the Worldwide Church of God and Armstrongism, and God moved me to Italy to marry a secular Englishman and then draw us both to him and reform us through your books. So thank you very much.
That's an interesting path.
Oh, very. To God be all the glory. And my husband is now a Southern Baptist pastor, and so our congregation here is gradually becoming reformed as they search the scriptures for what the scriptures have to say.
Oh, good.
My question is, last week you had guests, and one of them left a picture of a tandem bicycle that is currently missing from behind you.
I actually held it up at the beginning of the program.
Oh, shoot. I missed the first few minutes.
Yeah, I held it up and demonstrated that it was obviously a part of the fake news plague that is afflicting our nation right now, because there is the... as I look at it, not only is the person that's supposed to be me much, much larger than I am, but both people are wearing totally inappropriate clothing for riding. I wear at least Louis Garneau or Pearl Izumi or even Castelli bicycle wear. And there's no gloves, no helmet. You do not get on a bike without a helmet. No one is good enough to avoid dogs, cats, and various sundry other things that will eventually put you on the ground. And the most important thing is the individual is wearing shoes with no socks, which is absolute insanity on a bike. And the other person is wearing flip-flops, which is even more insane on a bike. And so you put all that together, and there's definitely some lack of cycling knowledge involved in the production of this obviously CNN inspired piece of propaganda.
Oh, totally.
Yes.
Next week, with the Southern Baptist Convention going on up in Phoenix, I hope that many of the people there will tune in to what you are saying. I've had Twitter wars, so to speak, with other SBC church leaders who refuse to see the limited atonement. When I point out that they're universalists, they inform me that since I'm a Calvinist, they won't talk to me and block me.
So yeah, I've had that happen a few times myself.
So I thank you very much for your ministry. You are in our prayers. I pray for your health when you're on trips.
Thank you.
And I pray for your wife's patience.
yeah, that's she needs that. She needs that, definitely. Thank you, Elizabeth. Sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, right. Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye. Down in Morenci, that's... It gets a little warm down there. Gets a little warm. Let's just take these last three. You can busy the rest of them out here. Let's talk to Ryan. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Dr. White. How you doing?
Doing good.
I got a question for you. So I've kind of gone round and round on Twitter with some people. From same people that you went round and round with over your famous incident about race.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is how can I, as a layman, kind of guard my church against that sort of ideology that's, behind, campus social justice warriors and that kind of stuff?
Well, I don't know that a layman can do that. I would think that it would be the responsibility of the elders to, through the ministry of the word, provide a balanced understanding of the fact that in Christ Jesus there is no male nor female, there is no bond or free, no Scythian. Those are, by the way, those are categories of races and peoples and things like that. The reality is that if we're in the body of Christ and we have been reconciled to God and hence to one another in and through Jesus Christ, and if you lay that kind of foundation out, if you treat everyone in the appropriate biblical fashion, then you've provided at least an inoculation against that kind of thing. I am well aware of the fact that that I'm in somewhat of the minority these days. There is a unsettling number of evangelical leaders that have bought into what I think are some truly problematic perspectives when it comes to social justice issues and things like that. But I can only be accountable for, my little part of the world and try to sort of sound a warning to others. But as far as an individual is concerned, that's, you can pray for your elders, talk to your elders, let them know that you certainly see that it's an area of concern and make sure that they know it's an area of concern. But other than that, I would think that would be really something that would be handled first and foremost, not by some kind of special church meeting or something, but just the regular, consistent ministry of the word from the pulpit.
Awesome. Thanks, Dr. White.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Awesome.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's talk with Ben in Pennsylvania. Hello?
Well, good afternoon, Dr. White. How are you?
But pretty good.
This isn't actually Ben from Pennsylvania, but
yeah, I know who it is. Well, yeah, I know who it is.
No, you don't know who it is. But I, with the 500 year anniversary of the Reformation coming up,
are you trying to use do you have like a sock over the phone or something?
Oh no, I have a voice harmonizer on this line.
I see. I was just hoping it was a smelly sock, so that you were having to smell a smelly sock while doing that.
I think that is game over land.
No, game over land.
Oh, yes. Come on, Rich.
Yeah, out the
We're gonna have fun with this. Let me see here. There he is. Okay.
I'm not at my desk right now.
Well, that's okay. It won't make any difference because when you get back, your Nick will be in pros purgatory frying really well. So
you realize
you sound a little bit like Darth Vader, except with a hangover, right?
Let all people know that the caller is the liar known as Alan.
No, he is not Ben. It's not Ben.
And he lied to me when he screened it. Yes.
Well, congratulations, Red. You at least got past.
And the first thing I'm going to do when this show is over is I'm going to find out what telephone number he called in on and block it.
No, I used a spoof card to call in.
Oh, a spoof card.
That's quite all right.
I have lots of space to add numbers onto the block list.
Well, listen, we just want to know, Dr. White.
Yes, we.
Now that the Regular Reform Guys podcast is over, at least for temporarily.
Yes.
We want to know why you never took us up on our countless interview requests.
Because I knew you were going to self-destruct anyways. So, yeah.
No, it wasn't a self-destruct. We went out on top.
Went out on top of what?
We went out on top like Jordan, like Michael Jordan.
Like Michael Jordan. Oh. Well, okay. Have a very humble view of y'all's performance there. That's good. I just wanted to give it time.
Obviously, I'm joking.
Yes, yeah, you are. I just wanted to give it time and just see how it went. You know, we just see.
Here, I thought that this poor man had voice issues.
I knew that's what you were trying to tell me.
And
you're
like,
okay, go ahead, just go with it. And I realized immediately who it was. And you're just like, just go with it. You know, try to be nice to the guy.
The next time I encounter Alan,
just call him Red.
I would not turn my back if I were you, Alan. I would not. I really would not, because what is in store for you will be very messy.
Oh my! Oh my! Well, you know what we could do is we could stick him on hold here and start telling all of our various Alan Cruz stories. That would be enjoyable.
Some of those are not appropriate to share.
Well, that you exposed yourself to the public humiliation. So, I think Ben is actually calling in now. So,
all right, look, I'm going to go.
That might be a good idea.
Talk to you gentlemen later.
All right, bye.
All right,
bye bye. All right, one more. No. Rich, just one more. All right, let's talk to Bryson. Hi, Bryson. Sorry about that. You're not using a spoof card, are you?
No, I'm not using anything like that.
That's good.
I was just calling to ask about, because when I have conversations with Catholics and things like that, they try to attack the way we understand justification and sanctification, how we make the distinction between the two, and they try to tell me that there are verses in the Bible that actually say that regeneration does what justification does, and it makes our doctrines weary. I've heard somebody go to, like, Titus 3:5. There's places like 1 Corinthians 6:11. What else we got? Some verses in Acts, things like that. So the thing that I wanted to ask you was, when faced with questions like that, where they try to say that our understanding of, you know, imputed righteousness and justification and things like that aren't biblical because there are passages that quote-unquote say that regeneration does what justification does, what is the biblical response that we should give back to that?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean, to be honest with you, because, the only one that I caught there really quickly was Titus 3:5. That he saved us not on the basis of deeds we have done righteousness, but according to his mercy by the washing, regeneration, renewing by the Holy Spirit, whom he. Unless you cut regeneration off and put it over in one place, and justification's over here, and sanctification's over there, and washing's over here. And they're not related to one another, but they're all part of the same divine act. So all we're doing is distinguishing necessarily, in light of Paul's own argument in Romans and Galatians, as to what justification is, the grounds upon which it's made, so that there cannot be a Jewish Christian church and a Gentile Christian church. There cannot be distinctions as to the basis upon which you are made right before God. Unless they're making that kind of argument, which as a Roman Catholic they can't, because they actually are the ones that confuse these things. They're the ones that confuse justification and sanctification. They're destroying all the distinctions. So, other than that, I don't. Regeneration here does not do what justification does here. I can't respond to it because the question doesn't make any sense to me, at least in regards to Titus 3:5 and 6.
Okay. Yeah, because when I was looking at some, like, Roman Catholic videos trying to go at Protestantism and things like that, that would be one of the verses that would come up. And I had questions about it because, like, I felt like you feel now. Like, I don't understand how that makes any sense, but this is supposedly a knockdown argument. And I saw on Twitter some Vatican Catholic guy was trying to go at you again, and I was like,
Look, if you're talking about the Diamond Brothers, you're talking about a teeny tiny little cult in a monastery someplace. They're not even Roman Catholics. They're not Orthodox.
Are they conscious or something like that?
Yeah. It's a tiny little loony cult, and I keep having people saying, "Well, why don't you engage them? Why engage tiny little cults? It's not representing Roman Catholicism. What are you trying to accomplish? Why should anyone invest their time with a group of alleged monks that are in a teeny tiny little group someplace, and that spend their time playing my Dividing Line videos in slow motion to try to come up with places that they can indicate that I'm demonized? I mean, these people are not playing with a full deck. So unless people in Twitter land think that this is a sport, it's an entertainment thing, that's not why I do debates. That's not the reason to do debates. You don't just take on every person that comes along just for the enjoyment of doing it. You actually try to make it to where it's going to have usefulness down the road. When that little cult group disappears, what good is any debate with them going to be? So it's just a matter of prioritizing based upon what could actually be meaningful. So look, you'll find all sorts of folks out in internet land that think arguments that actually have zero meaning to them are knockdown, dragout arguments. And we have to develop the kind of maturity in reading that type of material that allows us to recognize those issues. So I appreciate the phone call today, brother, and thanks for holding on during the weirdness that came before that. We'll see you.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye. I don't know what was going on there. Sounds like he was being attacked by a bag of peanuts right there at the end. All right. Well, hey, it's going to be a weird length program. And what is an hour and 39 minutes or something like that? But life will go on. So, Lord willing, we'll be back on Thursday. And then next week, fun with Southern Baptists. I don't know what that's going to mean or what it's going to look like, but we'll see. So we'll see you on Thursday. Lord willing, God bless.